Hi everyone, it's Nancy. We'd like to invite our listeners who are also fans of professional wrestling to tune in to Brady Bird Media's newest podcast, You're Never Too Old to Watch Wrestling. It's the perfect show for those of us who are busy being grown-ups but still want to keep up with the entertaining world of pro wrestling. Hosts AC and Paul are smart, funny, and experts in all things wrestling. New episodes drop every Friday, and you can find You're Never Too Old to Watch Wrestling on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and most applications for downloading podcasts. In the early 1980s, researchers at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention published an article expressing concerns over the deaths of five young men. The men, who'd had no previous health issues, had all died of a rare lung infection, and, it was noted, the men's immune systems had stopped working. It was the first official reporting of what would become the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Over the next few years, it became the stuff of nightmares as more and more men succumbed to the cancers and other diseases triggered by HIV/AIDS. Because the first victims noted were gay men, the public lexicon termed it, quote, gay cancer, end quote. The medical profession even first named it GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. It was years before the world came to terms with the fact that human immunodeficiency virus, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, HIV/AIDS, is an opportunistic virus that can be transmitted by gay and straight sex, through tainted blood transfusions, or by infected drug users sharing needles. As of 2016, HIV/AIDS has killed more than 500,000 people in the United States. Promising new treatments are becoming available, and someday HIV/AIDS will be eradicated. It will be consigned to the long list of nightmare diseases that we've battled and defeated. But at the center of every nightmare is a monster that we want punished. In the history of HIV/AIDS, the monster's name was Gaetan Dugas, Patient Zero, the guy who gave AIDS to America. There's just one thing wrong with pinning the blame on Gaetan Dugas. He didn't do it. Welcome to the final episode of this special Witch Hunt podcast miniseries. We'd like to thank Creative Salem for supporting the podcast. Based in Salem, Massachusetts, Creative Salem is an organization of like-minded creative individuals with the mission of ensuring that creativity and the arts are a relevant part of daily community and small business life, and educating people on the importance of arts and creativity in the community. If you still believe that French-Canadian airline host Gaetan Dugas single-handedly kicked off the AIDS epidemic in the United States, it's probably because you either read or saw the film version of Randy Schultz's popular 1987 AIDS history and the band played on. Schultz's book and film are particularly harsh on Dugas, portraying him as an embittered, angry man infected with AIDS who knowingly spread the deadly virus as a way to take as many people down with him as he could before he died. Born in Quebec in 1953, Gaetan Dugas was handsome, dashing, and very much out as a gay man in the 1970s. The CDC became aware of him when it began tracing the sexual histories of men known to be infected with AIDS. To protect the identities of the men, researchers listed them using the alphabet, not numbers. In other words, there never was a patient zero. But there were patients A through N before Dugas, who was tagged patient O. When his identity was leaked, the O became a zero, and the rest is unfortunate history. Those who knew Dugas vigorously defended him against Schultz's accusations. And in fact, before his death of AIDS-related kidney failure in 1984, Dugas voluntarily worked with the CDC, detailing his sexual history and providing information about the onset of his illness. He volunteered at a nonprofit helping out other people with AIDS. Arizona scientists researching the history of HIV/AIDS most recently have confirmed that Dugas was not responsible for triggering the epidemic. The strain of HIV/AIDS carried by Dugas and others was already here by way of Haiti, and it had been here since 1970 or 1971. It was just so rare that researchers didn't yet have a handle on what was happening. Gaétan Dugas has been called the Typhoid Mary of AIDS, and in some ways, it's a fitting moniker. Like Mary Mallon, better known as Typhoid Mary, whose story we explored in episode 2 of this podcast miniseries, Dugas was scapegoated as having unleashed deadly disease on thousands. The truth is that both Mallon and Dugas were disease carriers who likely infected a few dozen people. Still troubling, but not thousands, and certainly neither Mallon nor Dugas were the epicenter of an epidemic. And yet, history is very hard on them. Why? When someone gets sick, whether it's contagious or not, society tends to react in two ways. First, we want the sick person as far away from us as possible. Second, we unleash our wrath on them for getting sick in the first place. Michelle Lent Hirsch is the author of Invisible: How Young Women with Serious Health Issues Navigate Work, Relationship, and the Pressure to Seem Just Fine, a hybrid of journalism and memoir forthcoming next year from Beacon Press. You can pre-order it online. She's written for The Atlantic, The Guardian, Smithsonian Magazine, and Psychology Today. Her poetry has appeared in journals including The Bellevue Literary Review and Rattle. In 2011, Lent Hirsch was quarantined in a hospital room in New York as part of treatment for thyroid cancer, which required her to swallow enough radiation to kill the cancer, but not her. The treatment made her a radioactive danger to everyone around her. She spoke to us about her experience. Why do you think people tend to resent others for getting sick? You know, when you got cancer, you didn't get it on purpose just so you could become radioactive. Why do we get mad at people for getting sick?
The expert I quote in my essay is a psychology professor who specializes in people with infectious disease. And yeah, one of the things she told me is that when you're perceived as a potential vector of disease, it can rob you of your sense of self or your sense of self-worth. I do think maybe that's, you know, one of the main reasons that people resent it when you're sick is that it's a deep fear that you're going to give them your disease, right? And I think that even for those of us who've been through multiple serious illnesses, there's still some instinct in us. You know, if someone coughs all over me, it's not like I'm pleased just because I have empathy for them being sick. It's important to be real about the fact that we do have this fear of disease. And I think if I were to pretend that I stopped having that just because I've been on the patient side, that would not be accurate. But on the other hand, yeah, I think one of the reasons there's so much stigma attached to it is also a less direct reason, which is that I think sick people remind other people that they are going to die one day. I think a lot of it really does come down to that, and I'm exploring that a lot in my book that's coming out next year. I think that something like radioactivity or Ebola is contagious, right? And yet that doesn't explain why there's a stigma around cancer, right? Or autoimmune disease, where there's absolutely no contagion, there's no risk to someone else. And the fact is that that fear and that disgust remains. And I really do think a lot of it I found in my research and my own experience has to do with just people, especially in this country, don't want to be reminded of their own impending death, honestly.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, I grew up in a family that wouldn't even actually say the word cancer. They just called it the C word. Those who design and enforce quarantines are sort of really tasked with finding an almost impossible balance between respecting personal freedom and protecting healthy people from getting sick. And in your essay, you write about this sort of weird situation where you were deemed, quote, sort of safe to go home, but you couldn't drive yourself home and you couldn't be within 20 feet of anybody. How did you get home?
So I was quarantined for about 3 days in the hospital. And after that, they sent me home to finish my quarantine. So I was still radioactive. I was just a little less radioactive. And I was going to spend, I think, 4 or 5 more days at my mother's apartment, the apartment where I grew up actually in Manhattan, continuing to not be around anyone except, of course, my mother was there. So they said to stay about 20 feet away from her at all times. As you said, somehow I had to get home. So the doctors said to me, okay, so you'll take a taxi home. I was very weak at the time due to other aspects of the treatment, and I couldn't walk even if I wanted to, and they forbade me from taking a bus or a subway or public transportation. And I said to them, hold on, you're telling me I can't go within 20 feet of my own mom, but I can sit right behind a taxi driver for 20 whole minutes on the way home. It didn't make any sense to me. And they kind of gave me a wishy-washy answer about how basically there was no other way for me to get home and it wasn't going to be that dangerous for the driver. But then they kept telling me I couldn't go near my mom. And I'm a patient who pushes back a little bit, you know, when something doesn't make sense. And even in my weakened state, I said to them, this just doesn't really jive with what you were saying, you know? And the truth is, I think there was no way to get me home that was safe for everyone, right? I couldn't physically walk. They didn't want me on the bus. The only alternative was to take a cab. And I said to them, should I tell the cab driver that, you know, I mean, I felt kind of guilty being near this guy in his car and he doesn't know that I'm radioactive. And they kind of said to me, eh, it's fine. But once you're home, don't go anywhere near your mother.
And don't eat off of her plates and don't use her forks and don't, right. You know, everything right. else that went with it. And once you were cleared to have contact with humans again, how did you ease back into that? Was there any sort of residual behaviors that you saw from people or that you experienced even after you were kind of cleared for hugs again?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think in my case, my mom wished she could have hugged me while I was radioactive. And I think in some ways, I was the one saying, you know, stand back. I don't want to give you this. And so I think it was me, the patient, I was being more protective of her than she was in some ways. So I think the minute the week was up, I can't remember exactly, but I'm assuming she gave me a giant hug and, you know, she'd been this worried mother who couldn't get anywhere near her sick child for a week. I think in some ways she rushed over to me. But yeah, I think it actually affected how I was after a week. I still felt like I was a freak that people shouldn't go near. You know, I think I had really kind of internalized that.
How were you able to get through that?
You know, I think part of it is I was just so happy to be able to get fresh air and be outside that I got over it because I'd been trapped indoors for a week. I remember specifically, I had just started dating someone, and this was the very beginning of our relationship. I write about this a lot in my book because it brings up a lot of issues. Basically, I told him, you know, I'm done being radioactive, but I understand if you don't want to go near me right away because you're scared. And he was pretty amazing. And he said, no, as long as you're feeling energetic enough, let's go on a date. And so again, in this case, and I don't know if this would be true of other people, but the two people who were physically near me, my mom and the person who I was dating, they were actually both really excited to be near me. And I was the one who I think was more scared that I was going to hurt them.
I think that does make a lot of sense because, as you said before, it sort of really affects your sense of self and your sense of you're being a carrier, even though you really weren't contagious anymore.
Right.
After having experienced quarantine, what's your perspective on how public health officials can find sort of the least restrictive but safest solutions for future contagions? Because there's something out there that's coming.
I do not envy them their jobs. I do think it's probably, as much as I very much have empathy for other people who've been quarantined, like folks during the Ebola crisis, I also do have some empathy for the doctors and health officials making these decisions because it's got to be somewhat hard. On the other hand, I think part of the way that my experience, you know, gives me perspective on this is that I know that each patient being quarantined is a person. And I think that when you're an official making public health decisions in the interest of, you know, the greater good or public health, these big concepts, you do probably forget that each person you're quarantining is a human just like you. And I think that people maybe forget the psychological toll that I think they also often themselves have not been quarantined, right? And so it's really hard to understand until you go through it just how much it kind of wreaks havoc on your sense of self and your sense of self-worth.
And what advice would you give to somebody who unfortunately might be having to go through what you went through and have to spend a week or two in isolation because of an illness? How would you tell them to prepare themselves?
That's a great question. And actually, one of the things I wish that public health officials, or just in my case, doctors, had done for me is I wish they'd put me in touch with someone who'd been through it. I think that would be one piece of advice, right, is to just talk to someone who's been through it for the same illness, if you possibly can, or the same reason. There's all these small things that I think the doctors aren't going to warn you. I think that's what I would tell someone, you know, you're going to feel like a freak. One of the people I quote in my essay, she said she felt like an alien. You know, I think they don't warn you about that. I think I would also, I don't know, tell someone to try to find a way to remember that they're a good person and they haven't done anything wrong, because I think that gets lost.
It's not a moral failing to get sick.
Exactly. And I think I would just want to keep emphasizing that to someone before they went into this sort of isolation cone.
The Witch Hunt podcast is written by me, Nancy Matus Bird, and produced by Dan Bird. Thank you to Cody Dexter for our theme music and to Adam Dreyfus for our logo. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the upcoming season 2 of our podcast, please send an email to producer Dan Bird at dan@brainybirdmedia.com. And it's spelled Brainy Bird with a Y, B-R-A-I-N-Y. B-Y-R-D. We're going to be taking a short break while we put season 2 together. In the meantime, please keep in touch. You can follow us online at brainyburnmedia.com/witchhuntpodcast, on Facebook at Witch Hunt Podcast, on Instagram at Witch Hunt Podcast, and on our Twitter feed, Witch Hunt Pod. You can also email us at witchhuntpodcast@gmail.com. It would also help us out a lot if you would leave us a review on iTunes. We'll even send you a gift to say thank you when you send us a link to your iTunes review. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon with season 2 of the Witch Hunt podcast. I promise you, it is going to be fantastic.